funding for THINK comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
In the late 1990s, when Special Investigator Kenneth Starr was looking into whether President Clinton lied about an affair, Starr made headlines by requesting Monica Lewinsky's receipts from Barnes & Noble, presumably because her choice of books might reveal something about her. Maybe a few book titles would be illuminating, maybe they wouldn't. But ask yourself, what picture would somebody form of you if they could see every search term you'd typed into Google? From KERA in Dallas, this is THINK. I'm Chris Boyd. It's possible you haven't told anybody about that embarrassing medical thing you have going on, or that you have doubts about your relationship, or that you ever wished you'd had a family, or that you sometimes wish you didn't. There's a good chance you have revealed such things to the Google search bar, which delivers whatever answers we request without delay or judgment. But make no mistake, those searches are indeed being counted and cataloged, even if they're anonymized. And decades of data have revealed that what we search for often contradicts what we say about ourselves. Seth Stevens Davidowitz is a visiting lecturer at the Wharton School and former Google data scientist. His new book is called Everybody Lies: Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. He joins us from the studios of NPR in New York City. Seth, welcome to THINK.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
You call this book a kind of next-level Freakonomics. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think Freakonomics is a book I really loved, and I devoured that just when I was out of college and thought it was really, really cool. I think the one thing that I think thought was missing from Freakonomics is it was all these kind of quirky questions, whether sumo wrestlers cheat or what real estate agents do. And I think it didn't answer some of the bigger questions of kind of who we are as a society and stuff. And I think with some of this newer, bigger data sets, we're able to really go after larger, more fundamental, more profound, I think, questions.
What do people tell Google without maybe intending to tell Google with the things they search?
Well, there's sometimes just dark things that people tell. I've done a lot of research on racism in the United States, and I was shocked when I first did this research how frequently people make racist searches, namely jokes mocking African Americans in the United States. And I was also shocked by where these searches were located. I would have guessed that racism would be predominantly concentrated in the Deep South, but that's not true at all. Many of the areas where racism is highest include Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan. The real divide is not North versus South, it's East versus West.
Nate Silver found an interesting overlap between the GOP primary and racist search terms.
Yeah, that racist searches on Google was the single strongest correlation that he could find with support for Donald Trump in the Republican Party primary.
I was interested to learn that people lie even in anonymous surveys. Why would anybody do that?
I think first of all, we frequently lie to ourselves. So if we're lying to ourselves, we can't be honest to a survey. So something we did a while ago, we pretend we didn't do it. We kind of block it out of memory. And there's also just people are in kind of a habit of lying unless they have a really, really strong reason to tell the truth. People are in the, you know, lie to friends and neighbors and family members, so that behavior kind of carries over in a survey.
What are the biggest challenges for data analysts in making sense out of what amounts to a fire hose of information?
I think you definitely want to be cautious. There are kind of a lot of just weird correlations that may just be just by chance, aren't really fundamental. But I think in general, if you are cautious, there's just so much information out there that we really can get dramatically new insights into the human psyche. If you're in business, into your customers, if you're in a nonprofit, into, you know, your city or your the group you're working with, there's just so much rich information there. I don't want people to be too scared away by some of the pitfalls, although I do discuss them in the book.
How safe are our searches from being made public? We're talking here about anonymized data and looking at patterns across relatively large populations. Can we feel confident that what we search for online will stay private?
I think you can if you use one of the bigger search engines. So I think Google is probably actually one of the places your data is safest because they have the world's best data scientists and computer scientists trying to keep that data safe and preventing hackers from getting access to it. I think you really have to be more careful when you give data to a smaller site that doesn't have a sophisticated security team. We saw that in the Ashley Madison leak. It wasn't kind of a that was a site that didn't have didn't devote the resources that Google or Facebook does to protecting the data, and the data was leaked and was a huge embarrassment to many people.
So some things that can be really interesting are when you track data points that seem to correlate with one another. How do you know if those things are a coincidence or if they're significant?
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of tools that data scientists have, so you can do an analysis to basically check if there's something else explaining your result. If you see that racism is correlated with Trump support, you say, well, that doesn't mean that racism was a factor in Trump support. Is there some other explanation? Is it because places with high racism also have older people, or also have more conservative people, or also have more people who are out of work? And you start testing all these hypotheses, and one by one they fall away until all that's left is that racism played a big role in Trump's rise.
You note that our fascination with the dramatic can make gut instincts about information unreliable in a way that raw data does not. So, for example, people tend to assume that more Americans die in tornadoes than die of asthma attacks.
Yeah, I think so part of the book is kind of a defense of the data scientist approach to life. There have been a lot of other books who are kind of talk about how we have to trust our intuition and trust your gut. And I think that can be really problematic because we're constantly deceived about how the world works. And yeah, we do tend to we focus on very salient examples. Tornadoes or crime, most people think that crime is rising, although crime's actually dropping. So I think data can really correct for these biases that we all have in trying to understand the world and give you a much more accurate view of how the world really works.
Some of this stuff can be really helpful, or has the potential to be really helpful in the medical field. Will you talk a little bit about the search terms that turn out to be common among people who are later found to have pancreatic cancer?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite studies with big data. So researchers analyzed anonymous de-identified users over time, and they found that in millions of among millions of users, there were some of them who unfortunately had gotten a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. They searched, just got pancreatic cancer. What do I do? Diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And what they did is they looked at the symptoms these patients were searching in the months leading up to the diagnosis. And they found really, really subtle patterns of symptoms that would predict that someone soon will get a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. For example, indigestion followed by abdominal pain is a risk factor for pancreatic cancer. Indigestion by itself is not a risk factor. And that's like a really, really subtle pattern. I also don't want to freak out listeners. If anybody's
Who
like
have
me,
both, right?
no, if anyone's like me, as soon as this evening, they're going to convince themselves they have indigestion and then abdominal pain. I'm a hypochondriac, so I feel if any users or any listeners are the same way. But I think that's like a almost revolutionary type of medicine because the current approach to diagnosing a disease is not as sophisticated as looking at the detailed symptoms that tens of thousands of patients type in and picking out really, really subtle patterns in that time series of what's a risk factor and what isn't a risk factor. And the importance of doing this for pancreatic cancer is actually if you get a diagnosis months earlier, it can dramatically improve your chances of surviving.
So I've thought about this, Seth. The people on the Think team here, we do a lot of strange searches based on, content for the show. About a year ago, I was reading a novel and a character had syphilis, and so I went down this like rabbit trail of researching it. Did I convince somebody analyzing data at Google that there's like a spike in syphilis cases in Dallas?
I don't think so. So there definitely are not every search. You can't from an one search know anything about a person. I mean, I've done research on racist searches, and when I was doing that
Yeah,
research, I
yeah.
made all these horrible searches, and I think, you know, what one of the things, these data sets are so large that people making these one-off research searches are just a very small percentage of the overall searchers, and you still get a tremendous amount of information from where these searches are highest. So I don't think syphilis, you know, Dallas is going to get a spike of syphilis from you and a few of your colleagues doing some searches on that, because there are so many more people who are making searches who actually have syphilis.
All right. I want to talk about people lying to themselves or deluding themselves. Parents in the aggregate are more likely to believe their sons are gifted and their daughters are too fat.
Yeah, well, that's yeah, that is exactly an example of lying to ourselves, where I think most parents in the United States today like to think that they treat their sons and daughters the same way. But if you look at Google searches with the phrase "my son" and Google searches with the phrase "my daughter," you see differences. Parents are about twice as likely to ask, "Is my son gifted?" than "Is my daughter gifted?" and about twice as likely to ask, "Is my daughter overweight?" than "Is my son overweight?" So no matter what they think, in average, in aggregate, parents are much more excited about the intellectual potential of their sons and much more concerned about the physical appearance of their daughters.
So I know that the websites I frequent know exactly where I like to buy clothes and shoes because I get a whole lot of ads served up. I'm curious about whether companies' search engines are using these data deliberately to figure out a lot of social science questions, or are they offloading this to people at universities to analyze this data?
I think it's mostly, yeah, the data is being sent to universities. It actually, when this data first came out, I think there was actually not that much excitement about it in the world of social science. I think people thought the data was so weird. We're used to surveys, and surveys have, you know, are weighted very carefully, and methodologists have been studying surveys for, you know, 90 years and perfecting the weighting. So the idea that you could learn anything from these strange searches that people make, was kind of not really taken very seriously, and many academics just ignored the data set. But now more and more you are seeing academics you know, studying these new internet data sources.
So how does this work for politics? Because I might search for candidate X because I think she's brilliant, and I might search for candidate X because I can't stand her and I can't wait to find a negative article.
Yeah, I think so. That's one of the top questions I get is, can you predict elections with search data? And the simplest way to do it is exactly what you're suggesting. Just put, you know, which candidates search more. If Clinton search more, assume a state will go Clinton, and if Trump search more, assume a state will go for Trump. And that does not work for the exact reason you mentioned, that some people search Trump because they love him, people search Trump because they hate him. But there are subtle indicators in the searches people make about which way they may go. One of my favorite is you can predict which way someone will vote based on the order in which they list candidates. So if someone searches for Clinton-Trump polls, they're more likely to go Clinton. If they search Trump-Clinton polls, they're more likely to go Trump. In other words, if whoever you list first, you're more likely to support that candidate, even if you might not even be aware yourself. That you support that candidate, but it's kind of a giveaway, a verbal tick in how you think of the election.
My guest is Seth Stevens Davidowitz, a former Google data analyst who is now a visiting lecturer at the Wharton School and author of Everybody Lies: Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program for aspiring creative writers. You can nurture your creative talents and take courses this fall like 21st Century Storytelling. Applications are available at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Seth Stevens Davidowitz, a visiting lecturer at the Wharton School and former Google data scientist. His new book is called Everybody Lies: Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. Seth, it's very interesting to me that most people know how to use search engines, and they know if you put things in quotes, you get the exact term. Turns out a lot of people type full sentences into search engines.
Yeah, that surprised me as well. You know, we usually think that the reason people use search engines is to ask questions or to get an obvious search looking for some information. But frequently people make searches that are just full statements. So people search, "I'm drunk," or "I'm sad," or "I hate my boss." And it's not totally clear what they want from Google in this situation. I think it reminds me a little of the confessional box in Catholicism, where people feel comfortable telling things to Google that they might not tell to anybody else. There's something almost cathartic about confessing your secrets to Google.
People confess things to Google that they would not confess to anyone else. And you found some really interesting information about people who have children.
Yeah, this was a little bit depressing. But I think, you do see that one of the searches people confess is that they regret having children. And this is about four times more likely to be searched than regretting not having children, even taking into account how frequently people have children and don't have children. So that's kind of interesting. It's something that's usually not talked about, regretting having children, but it is something you do see in Google searches.
It's interesting that it comes up because it's one of those things that you're just really not allowed to say. And I wonder if there's any way to take into account the fact that people, let's just say that you type, "I regret having children," after you have like the worst day ever, right? And, you know, if someone has thrown up and whatever. Is there any way to balance that against all the, you know, social media posts where people put pictures of their adorable 5-year-old in a nice clean outfit and, you know, boast about their families? Is there a way to sort of get perspective on this?
Yeah, so, well, I totally agree with you that you can't just say, okay, children may be the best decision they've ever made in their lives. You know, it's the apple of their eye. And yeah, they're working on 2 hours of sleep, and, you know, their kid wakes them up and missed the bus to school, and they have to take them. And it's just like, oh, God, I regret having kids. And it's just a momentary thought. But I think it is, in general, interesting to compare the very cultivated selves we tend to put forth on Facebook with the selves we present to Google, which can be very, 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 very different. Almost night and day.
People give surveyors a really different picture of their sex lives than they give Google.
Yeah, so, well, in general, I think people exaggerate how much sex they have. The way you can see this is you compare how frequently people say they have sex and how frequently they use a condom. Basically, they're claiming far more condoms than are sold every year in the United States. And even if you do, how frequently they say they have unprotected sex using no protection with women of fertility age. If that were true, there would be more pregnancies every year in the United States, just doing the math. So basically, I think everybody, men and women, men a little more than women, lies about how much sex they have, exaggerates how much sex they have. I think there's a lot of pressure in our country to fib in the direction of more sex. And on Google, you do see a different picture. So the number one complaint about a marriage by far is that it's sexless. That's about 8 times more common than loveless or unhappy marriage, sexless marriage. And the number one complaint that everybody has about a partner, whether it's a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a husband, or a wife, is that the partner won't have sex with me. It easily beats the second most common complaint that a partner won't text me back. I think one of the things that that I like about this data is it does kind of sometimes go against conventional wisdom or stereotypes. So there are about twice as many complaints that a boyfriend won't have sex with me than that a girlfriend won't have sex with me, which, you know, I think in popular culture or conventional wisdom, males are sex-craved and always want sex, and women are kind of more prudish and withholding of sex. But you see this basically reversed on Google.
This is really interesting. Google data have provided some interesting insights into the percentage of the population that is or are gay men, but it's harder to figure out from Google searches how many lesbian women there are. Why is that?
So one of the obvious way to see how frequently people are gay, how frequently people are gay is based on pornographic searches. And you see, for example, in many states in the United States, if you ask surveys or look on Facebook, there are very, very few gay men in Mississippi and Tennessee and Oklahoma and places where it's harder to be gay. But you see in gay porn searches, almost as many men are making gay porn searches in these states. And it's kind of about 5% seem to be gay just about everywhere throughout the United States. I think it's harder for women for a few reasons, but one of them is that first of all, a lot fewer women consume porn. So that's a part of, for men, it's kind of just about 100% now. For women, it's about 20%. So it's a little harder to draw larger lessons about society. But I think with women, there is also this phenomenon of many women are straight, consider themselves totally straight, only want romantic relationships with men. But primarily watch lesbian porn when they watch porn, and it's kind of interesting. It's not like I don't think they're in the closet. They live in very maybe progressive communities, are very comfortable, would be comfortable if they were lesbian, but don't pursue romantic relationships with women. But for whatever reason, find that pornography more alluring.
What have search data demonstrated about the effect of restricting access to abortion in particular states?
Yeah, well, you see, I mean, there is a horrifying element to some of this data where you do see people who are in real trouble, in a real struggle in their life. Whether I talk about in the book child abuse, and you see, I mean, it's sad, it's tragic. You see children, confessing to Google that their mom or dad is beating them, and they're in real pain and real difficult situation, and you see that with abortion as well. I was shocked by how frequently people make searches for self-induced abortions. I'm basically convinced that America right now has a self-induced abortion crisis, I mean, parts of America at least, that for about every three searches Americans are now making for a legal abortion, for an abortion clinic, they're making one search how to do it on by themselves, how to have a miscarriage, how to end a birth naturally, even horrifyingly, how to use a coat hanger to give oneself an abortion. And these searches are predominantly concentrated in places where it's hard to get an abortion. In Mississippi, they're highest in Mississippi, where there's only one abortion clinic now. And they rose substantially in 2011 when many parts of the country began cracking down on legal abortion.
Can data predict behavior and help us identify people who are likely to do something wrong?
If anybody's watched Minority Report, there's this idea that you can use data analysis to predict crimes before they happen and maybe even jail someone before they do anything. And it's definitely possible. So you see people make really horrifying specific searches. So people search how to kill my girlfriend. I mean, that's pretty much directly saying what they're looking to do. I think it's possible that this data can be used to predict crimes. We obviously have to be really, really careful. I definitely support using this data at the area level. So if a lot of people are making murderous searches or suicidal searches, then you could do an intervention at the city level. I think we have to be really careful using this to predict an individual's behavior. It's not a crime in the United States to have a bad thought. So I don't necessarily support support using this data, but this data is definitely very, very powerful.
Seth, why do some stories go viral while others are quickly forgotten?
I think there's one tool that now companies are using is something called A/B testing. Basically, companies can divide their users into two groups, a treatment group and a control group. And they show one of these groups one headline and the other group a different headline. And then they see which one gets more clicks. and whichever one gets more clicks, they then show that headline to the whole to their entire audience. And what this they're able to do is find that sometimes just a subtle change, one word, you change one word in a headline, you can get 2, 3, 4 times more clicks. You can get a lot more shares on social media. So you can basically make a story go viral by just changing, a word or two in a headline. It's a very powerful tool that big companies are using to dramatically improve their profitability.
I don't know why this really bothers me, but it does. It feels so manipulative, even though I know that companies and media companies test things before they put them out there. There's something about this A-B testing that just rubs me the wrong way.
Yeah, I agree with that. You're kind of like a lab rat. Anytime you go around the internet, you don't even realize it. You're an A or a B in a test, basically, all the time. You're seeing some version of the site. You might be seeing a different text, different words, different colors, different buttons, just to try to find what makes people click more or stay on the site longer. It's scary stuff. It's powerful stuff, and it's not just that it makes you uncomfortable. I think there is a real danger to this. So if you look at a game like World of Warcraft, it's one of the reasons that game has become so addictive is because they use A/B testing. So over and over again, they're testing two different versions of their game, two different missions, and seeing which ones their users find more addictive. And then they do this over and over again until they basically have the most addictive video game ever. And why is Facebook or social media, why are they so addictive? Why is it so hard to stop? Well, it's because they test everything and they just keep the winners. And eventually you get something that's among the most addictive products that's ever been created. So I think there is definitely a danger to the power that this rapid experimentation gives to corporations.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Seth Stevens Davidowitz, visiting lecturer at the Wharton School and former Google data scientist. His new book is Everybody Lies: Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Seth, we all have reputations to uphold these days in day-to-day life, but also online. I love this. Equal numbers of Americans have paper subscriptions, hard copy subscriptions to The Atlantic and The National Enquirer. But when it comes to sharing or liking online, we're 27 times more likely to give The Atlantic a nod than The Enquirer.
Yeah, well, that's just kind of social media is one big lie where everyone's exaggerating how happy they are, how intellectual they are, how good their family life is. And, you know, that's one example of it. There's if you compare two hotels, Circus Circus and the Bellagio, Circus Circus is a budget, very cheap hotel. Bellagio is a luxurious, famous hotel. They actually hold the same number of people. So about the same number of people on their Vegas vacations are staying in each hotel. But people are about three times more likely to say they check in at the Bellagio on Facebook, right? So everyone wants their friends to think they're staying at the Bellagio on a Vegas vacation, or they don't want their friends knowing that they're staying at Circus Circus. They're trying to exaggerate their income or the luxury of their vacation. So social media is one big lie.
What have savvy companies learned about ignoring what people say they want and delivering what searches show they want instead?
So we're horrible at predicting what we're going to do in the future. You, me, every listener, we have an optimistic bias towards who we're going to be. We think we're going to exercise more than we will, and we think we're going to read more than we will and eat better than we actually will. So one example is Netflix. They, in some of their earlier versions, they asked users what movies they wanted to queue up in the future. So right now, users today, so let's say on Wednesday, users were watching whatever they were watching. What do you want to see Saturday? So we'll just have it ready for you when Saturday comes around. So what happens when Netflix asks users what they want to see in a few days? Oh, you know, the 13th century French documentary or the avant-garde film or, you know, the you know, whatever, these very intellectual movies. And then Saturday comes around and they come to Netflix. They say, hey, hey, look at what we have waiting for you. And people are just like, what the heck? I don't want to watch this. I want to watch the same lowbrow comedies and romance flicks that I've always watched, right? So Netflix realized, okay, we can't ask people. We just have to ignore what people say and just build algorithms based on what they've done in the past and what similar users want, and to predict what people actually will want to watch.
So you teach at the Wharton School, which is very prestigious. Is the Wharton School, does it turn out amazingly successful people because of something magical that happens on the campus and in the classroom? Or does it turn out successful people because it recruited the most successful students to begin with?
It's the latter. The evidence is increasing that good schools, I probably shouldn't say this if I'm, you know, if I'm affiliated with Wharton, that that people could go to a cheaper school and do just as well in life. But it's actually true that the way people have studied this is – so it's definitely true that students that go to, say, Harvard, you know, one of the most prestigious universities in the world, and student do better than students who go to Penn State, which is also a great university but a little less prestigious than Harvard. They'll earn more income over their lives and have more prestigious or high-status occupations. But what you can do is compare students who got into both Harvard and Penn State, and some of them choose Penn State and some of them choose Harvard. So these students, according to the admissions committees, were equally talented, but some chose the more prestigious school and some, for whatever reason, chose the less prestigious school. And these students turn out exactly the same in life. So basically the reason that students at these elite universities do so well in life is because they have, going in, have more going for them, not because the university added anything to them.
My guest is Seth Stevens Davidowitz, a former Google data scientist who is a lecturer at the Wharton School and author of a book called Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Email think at kera.org or find us on Twitter at keratHink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can cultivate your appreciation of great works of art by customizing your study with courses this fall like Inspiring Creativity Through Original Art. Applications are available at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Seth Stevens Davidowitz, former Google data scientist, author of the book Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. You can send email to think at kera.org, which is where we hear from Nicholas, who writes, Big data and new data fascinate me. I'm wondering, how does one get into big data analysis?
First, you have to buy my book, I would say, and then Everybody Lies. And then after that, you probably want to take some courses in data science, you know, whether an undergrad degree or a master's degree, and also practice a lot. The more you do it, the better you get at it, whether it's just even just having a blog where you find things that you may. So I use a lot of the tool Google Trends. So I always suggest to people, hey, start a blog and post interesting things you find about Google Trends and just get in the habit of, you know, what makes an interesting data finding.
And we can all have access to Google Trends, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
How do you do that?
Google Trends, I guess, is the best way. And then, or I don't remember exactly what the website is, but if you Google Google Trends, you can find it.
All right.
And it is fascinating because you do kind of see the human psyche in real time in a way that, you know, that we've never really previously been able to.
You went looking to find out who on Twitter was most like you.
Yeah.
What'd you find?
So one tool that data scientists use is called a K-nearest neighbor, which is a really boring term. So I renamed it a doppelganger search, which I think is a much better name and is true to the craft, which is you're basically looking around the internet to find the people who are most similar to you. And this is really a powerful tool. That's basically how Netflix now figures out what videos you might want to watch, or how Amazon figures out what books you want. Go around the entire internet, find the person most similar to you in preferences, and then find what books they enjoy that you might have not heard of yet. So basically the entire internet is driven by these little doppelganger searches at all points, your book doppelganger, your TV doppelganger, your media doppelganger. And I kind of tried to want to make that public to say, hey, here's who my doppelganger was. Although it wasn't that interesting, to be honest. It was another writer who I kind of knew anyway. So I'm like, I already got his recommendation. So I'm not sure I learned too much from that. But it was fun to play around with and this idea. I think it goes further that you can find your doppelganger for anything. You can I'm actually working with someone now on finding my food and drink doppelganger. So who in the world has the most similar taste to me? And then from that, I'll be able to potentially find some drinks or foods that I didn't know about that I might like.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Soubrette is calling from Fort Worth. Hi, Soubrette.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi, I just have one question regarding our data that Google and other search engines use, because I've seen whenever we search something in Google, they use the data that were the things that we're trying to search, and they try to send it to other companies so that we can study. If we search about a shoe or a video game in Facebook or other social media sites, we get versions of new shoes, new video games. So doesn't that act against our privacy? Are they using us against our privacy rights?
What do you know about that, Seth?
Yeah, I kind of agree that data is becoming so powerful that there are definitely privacy implications, and consumers can get left behind. Some of it's not so bad. If you search for a video game and then you might not find what you want, it might not be the exact right option, and then a little bit later the right video game comes around, it might not be so bad if on Facebook you're told about this video game. But some of the use cases are a little bit more scary, where companies can use data to make sure that you pay more money or pay a higher price than you'd ideally like to. So there definitely are big concerns here.
Is there evidence that our tastes can be shaped over time by the things that a Google search feeds back to us?
Not too much evidence yet. I think it's definitely an interesting question, how tastes are formed, and whether, so sometimes you click on something, sometimes you see an autocomplete and you may have, may become aware of something you didn't even know about, and then maybe that sends you down a rabbit hole. So it definitely could be affecting taste, but it's a tough question to research.
When you're trying to draw profiles, not of individuals, but of large groups of people, surely there are things that Google searches don't cover, but it's almost hard to conceive what those are. Have you given a lot of thought to the limitations of big data in trying to draw conclusions about the human condition?
Yeah, I definitely have. I think one issue with Google is it's kind of biased. So most data sources, people lie to make themselves look good. But in Google, I think there's almost the opposite tendency, where you ask Google the questions that you don't feel comfortable asking anybody else. It's kind of biased towards the embarrassing stuff or the socially unacceptable stuff. So it's definitely not a perfect data set, but I think it is revolutionary in the sense that there are some things that people don't tell anybody that we would have never otherwise known. Now we can know them.
If we had known what to look for, would fewer people have been surprised by the results of the elections last fall?
Probably. I found that there were definitely clues on Google that Trump may have done better than other people thought. So one example is, if you ask people before an election, are you going to vote? Pretty much everybody says they're going to vote, because it's embarrassing to admit that you're not going to exercise your civic duty. So you can't really use surveys to know who's going to turn out an election. But you can predict who will vote based on Google searches. If people search for how to vote or where to vote or polling places well before an election, this can predict with great accuracy whether they'll actually vote. And one thing you saw in the previous election is that these searches for voting information were dramatically lower than previous elections in communities with huge numbers of African Americans. So it was very, very clear in the Google search data that there was going to be low turnout among black voters. And this happened and cost Hillary Clinton a lot of votes in many key swing states.
All right, back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Lily is calling from Dallas. Hi, Lily.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
So my question is, how can big data trackers, these algorithms, how can they be detrimental to society?
Yeah, another great question. I think all the listeners seem to be much more focused on the fear of big data. I'm more excited by the things we can do with big data. But yeah, I definitely do agree. I think we saw this a little bit in the previous election with fake news, where the algorithm on Facebook just gives people what they want. And frequently people want to read stories that are provocative or shocking or controversial, whether or not they're true or false. So the traditional human input of only limiting stories that have been fact-checked serves a great value relative to an algorithm that just gives people stories that they want to read.
Coming up with interesting conclusions and novel things to look at requires a certain amount of creativity. And I don't know, Seth, that people necessarily associate data scientists with creativity, but maybe you can talk about what it takes to be inspired to think of a new set of data points to put together and compare.
Yeah, it is. If there were a formula, then it wouldn't be a creative process.
Right.
So you can't really say exactly what to do. I think a lot of it is being aware of the world and asking the questions, the right questions, the interesting questions, just as the listeners right now are kind of focusing on interesting questions. And that skill gets better and better the more you do it, that you get used to, looking for where you might find interesting information or an interesting finding. You can't necessarily teach it, but you're absolutely right. It is a creative process. I think that's one thing that people are very surprised about. I think people assume that data is going to be very formulaic and boring, and it's really not at all. It's creative and, I think, thrilling.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour, it's Seth Stevens-Davidowitz. We're talking about his book, Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. One thing we haven't talked about yet, Seth, is the things that big data can reveal about differences across cultures or between different cultures. So, for example, there are certain search terms during pregnancy that vary a whole lot if you're looking at India or Australia or Britain or Nigeria or South Africa.
Yeah, that's one of the really interesting use cases of this data is within a few moments, you can just compare what people search in every corner of the world. And sometimes you find that what people search is very similar, which also can be interesting. So, for example, the symptoms that women search around pregnancy, whether it's nausea or back pain or stretch anything else, they're all kind of very, very similar in every country. But the questions women have around pregnancy are all over the place. So in the United States, women are obsessed with stretch marks. How to get rid of stretch marks? How can I get rid of stretch marks? And in India, this question is like never asked. There in India, they ask, how can I have sex and how can I take care of myself while I'm pregnant? So it's totally different. And then the questions women have around what they can do when they're pregnant. In the United States, women are concerned. This probably doesn't surprise women that whether they can eat shrimp or drink coffee or drink wine. And we kind of think these are the natural questions that any woman would have around pregnancy. These are kind of the standard questions that woman would have, but it's not true. If you look at Nigeria, the top question that pregnant women have in Nigeria is whether they can drink cold water, and they would find that we ask whether we can drink coffee just as shocking as we find it that Nigerians ask whether they can drink cold water. So I think a lot of what's going on is just rumors are getting spread all the time and nobody really knows what's safe, what isn't. There's so much misinformation and the misinformation can vary tremendously in different parts of the world.
And I would imagine that you get different search responses if you're entering your query from Nigeria or India as opposed to the United States or Great Britain.
A little bit. Not. There aren't too many differences for these particular questions. I think there can be some differences. So things can get shifted even more based on the information you get. If you go to, let's say, a local message board in Nigeria, you may get different information around pregnancy than if you go to a local message board in the United States. But I think what these questions make me ask is, you kind of like, it's very easy to mock the Nigerians in this situation. Like, cold water, come on, of course you can drink cold water. Like, who would ever doubt that? But then you have to ask, like, is there going to be another society that's mocking us at some point for the questions we ask that seem similarly naive? It's interesting to see some of these differences.
Has this research made you give a lot of thought to the profile that would emerge about you based on your searches?
Well, the good thing is, because of the research I do, I'm pretty much in the clear. Like, anything that I've searched, I can always just say it was for research.
Yeah.
And people, I think, will believe me. So like, if my search data was ever hacked, I don't think I'd have any reason to be embarrassed, because I could just say, oh, that was for research.
What's ahead for the field of data analysis?
Pretty much everything. I think the internet, I think, is changing society in pretty dramatic ways. It's changing business. Some businesses, malls are virtually going out of business. People are stopping shopping offline. It's changing business. It's changing the media. You see Facebook and Google dominating ads. And I think it's also going to dramatically change the social sciences and really revolutionize the social sciences, where there's now all this information that people leave as they go through their digital lives that is now kept. So we're no longer have to rely on a survey of a few hundred people. We can now rely on the digital trails that billions of us leave every day as we just go through our lives.
Are we keeping records of what the internet looks like? Are big companies like Google doing that?
Yeah, there are historical. Nothing really totally goes away. There are people who keep the internet at different points. Yeah.
Seth Stevens Davidowitz is a visiting lecturer at the Wharton School and former Google data scientist. His new book is called Everybody Lies: Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. Seth, thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. You can subscribe to the podcast and learn about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.